Standing on the edge of a cliff, Delphi was admiring the scenic view on the other side of the chasm. Nevada was such a beautiful state, with all of the whitewater rivers, soaring hills, and jagged mountains. Even the nuclear war had done little to damage the majestic landscape. The colossal defenses of Cheyenne Mountain, the supreme headquarters for NORAD, had spared most of the West from the atomic ravishing of the war, even if Cheyenne Mountain itself was a glowing hell zone of tortured strontium nuclei and cesium-rich lava fields. But this was why Delphi had chosen the Lehman Caves of Nevada as his base of operations. There was little nuke damage and numerous pre-dark ruins to scavenge for supplies if necessary. And it had proved necessary. Glancing over his shoulder, Delphi checked to see how the work was progressing. A short distance away, the four war wags of his convoy were parked near the main entrance to the caves. A squad of his troopers was attaching tow chains to the boulders blocking the entrance, while Cotton and the others stood guard with the Kalashnikovs. Delphi smiled at that. This was the only way in or out of the labyrinthine maze of the Lehman Caves. Locks could be smashed, guard dogs slain, Sekhmen bribed, and landmines tripped. But simple boulders could only be removed by heavy machinery. High explosives would only make the front entrance to the caves collapse. True, the use of granite boulders was cumbersome and crude, but aside from moving to a redoubt, this was the only way to be sure that his home was completely undisturbed, and more important, undiscovered by any agents from Titan or Coldfire. Long ago, the cyborg had established numerous such disguised locales throughout the Deathlands as rewards for the Coldhearts he hired to do special tasks. Now the caches were his lifeline, a few precious depots of ammo, fuel, and tech. If he had only thought of adding some spare parts for himself, he would have saved himself from traveling the so-called Deathlands to dig up a chip here and a circuit board there, on top of using the jungle redoubt to raid the laboratories of Coldfire and Titan. But at least he now had enough supplies to finish his original mission, find Doc Tanner. That would get him reinstated with Coldfire, and then his real work could continue from this deplorable interruption. Suddenly, Delphi froze as he felt a cold sting of sharp steel pressed to his bare throat.
Don't move, Outlander. I've been watching this cliff for weeks, waiting for you to come back. And now you have wags and bags and all, sweet as a gaudy slut to her bed. Now give me your blaster, or I'll cut you like a mutey dog.
My troopers
are 100 yards away. And if those big blasters turn in our direction...
With unnatural strength, the man pushed Delphi closer to the edge of the cliff until the deep chasm yawned only inches from his shoes. The cyborg was impressed. To possess such colossal strength, the Coldheart clearly had more than a touch of mutiny in his blood.
One nudge, and you're flying, Phoebe. Now give me those blasters.
No, I don't think so.
Delphi mentally activated his new force field. As if moved by a wall of invisible steel, the man was shoved away from the cyborg, straight over the edge of the cliff. The cyborg rearranged his clothing and walked away from the cliff toward the waiting convoy. His sensor said there were no more hidden cold hearts in the rocks. It was silly of him not to check more regularly, but it didn't seem to be necessary anymore. Even after Tanner had nearly slain him and half of his systems were damaged, such primitive attacks had not been a real danger. Now he was stronger than ever. Walking around a boulder, Delphi found himself confronted by a dozen of his troopers from the convoy, with Cotton Davenport in lead. They looked concerned, and the Kalashnikovs in their hands were poised for combat. The rapid fire seemed rather bulky and ungainly from the addition of a 30mm Gren launcher under the main barrel, but they held the big bore weapons with confident ease.
We heard a scream, Chief. Is there trouble?
No, Cotton. No trouble. Is everything loaded?
Yeah, sure. The boulders are ready to move on your word.
Let's get inside and load up for another trip. A very long one this time. Weeks, possibly months.
Months? Shit, Chief, we could cross the world in that time. Where are we going?
A place called Front Royal in Virginia. We're going to find a certain canny by the name of Doc Tanner. He chilled a lot of my friends, and now it's payback time.
Several of the other troopers grimly nodded in agreement. All of them had lost kin to the cooking pots of the stinking cannies, and more than a few of them carried deep scars from viciously fighting the flesh-eating devils.
Cannies gotta get chilled, that's the nuke and truth. You sure this tanner is at, Fort Royal?
Front Royal. And no, I'm not sure. It's simply the best place to start. However, if we don't find him in Virginia, then we'll hunt for him elsewhere. Underground.
Underground? You mean in some sort of cavern like we have?
No, much better than this.
Delphi almost told Cotton about the redoubts, but stopped just in time. That knowledge would come later. First, he had to get to Tanner, and when he was accepted back into Coldfire, then, and only then, could the cyborg unleash his army of primitives into the Matran system and openly declare war on his masters. They abandoned him, left him to perish among the primitives as if he were a failed experiment, a mutie with too many legs, or a bioweapon that refused to kill. Never again would the cyborg allow others to hold such power over his life. But first, he would have to find Tanner. Tanner was the key to everything. Victory, revenge, and salvation. Eventually, the plants were gone in front of the lumbering wag. JB squinted into the night to see if there was more ground ahead or only empty air. Sharp cliffs rose around them in jagged profusion. Illuminated by the flickering beam of the remaining headlight was a hard, flat scrubland with only a few tufts and clumps of the millet growing sporadically amid the uneven barrens. In the distance, mist ruled the night, and the waterfall could be heard from somewhere nearby.
Dirt never looked so good. This might be a good place to fix the bastard tire.
I hear that. Okay, let's... Oh, son of a bitch, look behind us!
Glancing in the side-view mirror, Ryan grimaced at the sight of a dozen Selenodons coming out of the tall millet and into the wan moonlight. He'd never seen anything like it before in his life.
Wait here.
Ryan leapt out of the cab and approached the handful of muties with the AK-47. He warily studied the field of millet for any more of the little bastards.
That looks like the last of them, Ryan.
Mildred held her ZKR in a two-handed grip. Doc was behind her with a hurricane lantern.
Persistent little things, aren't they?
Yeah, indeed, madam. King Sisyphus was a slugabed in comparison to these arduously diligent Selenodons.
Refresh my memory. Exactly what the hell did you teach in school again?
English literature, but I was a most voracious reader of, well, everything.
I guess so.
Ryan looked up to see Jack holding a lantern and a Kalashnikov.
Them muties might be circling. Catch from the side.
No, impossible. They're too stupid for such complex thinking. I don't care how many folds their cerebral cortex may have. The heads are simply too small for them to be intelligent.
Hey, JB, kill the engine.
Right.
Might as well fix the tire before we go any further. Jack, stay on guard. Mildred and Doc, rustle everybody up some chow. JB and I will... Where's Christy?
Asleep. She's sleeping in one of the bedrolls. She took a bullet through her hair. It drained her.
Yeah, let her sleep. JB and I can fix the wag by ourselves.
Although we'll probably wake her anyway with the repairs.
The armorer walked into the glow of the lantern, wiping his hands on a rag.
There's a spare tire, but no spare rim. And the one we have is more warped than a boiled boomerang.
Any chance you can fix it? Hammer the rim back into shape?
Good enough for it to hold a seal? No way. If we were back at the redoubt, I could probably do something, but not out here. Now, I might be able to shift a couple of tires from the back and put them on the front, but that all depends on how many we have left.
Why two? Only one, flat.
Because the front tires are totally different from the rear. They're for steering the cab, while the ones in the flatbed are for supporting the cargo. They don't turn like the ones up front, and we need a matched pair to make the cab steer smoothly. Dark night, the front suspension is banged up enough from our ride through that damn marsh, on top of which the rear tires are bigger than the others. So we'll have to trim the damn planks, too.
Fair enough. But radiator's fixed, right?
Yeah, that's something at least.
Just then, white steam blasted onto the ground under the engine. Casting an angry look at the team, JB tugged his fedora on tighter and tramped back toward the cab. It was dawn before the companions got the Cyclops back underway again. Transferring the tires had been hard work, but the flatbed had built-in jacks for disengaging the locking mechanism of the cab, and the toolboxes had contained a wide assortment of wrenches, hammers, and crowbars. With an exhausted JB catching some additional sleep in the back, Christy was riding in the cab. She rested an elbow out the window, seemingly her old self again. A Kalashnikov rested across her lap, and a Kenny throwing axe lay on the seat between her and Ryan, along with a canteen of lukewarm coffee. After some discussion, the companions had decided to try for Tucsonville in the zone. There had been no trace of Delphi after the watery marsh, but since the friendly bill was roughly in this direction, it seemed the logical place to go. With the accursed cyborg on the move again, they'd need some place to use as a base of operations, and they were sure of a friendly reception from Baron O'Connor, as well as Sec Chief Sterling. On the downside, there was no way they had enough juice to reach the bill, but the reserve barrels of diesel in the flatbed would take them most of the way. That was good enough. With luck, they could find a vill and trade the Warwag for some horses, or buy more juice. Aside from the dried human trophies, the Kennys had kept a lot of the personal possessions of their victims. There were boxes of boots, pocket combs, harmonicas, and such in the back, along with several kegs of black powder, a bag of sharpened flints, a box of assorted knives, several axes, and a dozen flintlock rifles. As long as nobody recognized the Warwag of the Kennys, they were in good shape. Jack had tried to use some shine to remove the painting on the front planks, but it was made of some pre-dark stuff that stubbornly resisted being erased, so the teen had settled on hacking up the giant eye with an axe. Ryan soon found the remains of the highway that would take them more than halfway to Tucsonville. The gray asphalt was badly cracked, weeds growing out of every crevice, but it was still passable and went in the correct direction. Crossing a granite bridge, Ryan saw the sprawling ruin of a pre-dark city at the bottom of the gorge. A partially melted skyscraper rose above the flattened stores and burned homes, while a neat row of parked cars sat at a shopping mall. Ryan gave the ruins only a glance. He had seen similar things. When the nuke war came, the Titanic explosions annihilated anything near them, but everything else just a little farther away was sent tumbling. Once he'd found an intact iron bridge smack in the middle of a grassy field, the closest water 100 miles away. Willow and birch trees began appearing among the stately pines, along with something that resembled oak, and then a new variety of tree came into view. Climbing on a firing step, Doc grinned, showing his eerily perfect teeth.
Maple trees! Those are maple trees! The same as we had back in Vermont.
Maple syrup. It's been a long time since I've even thought about pancakes.
Pancakes? Waffles, madam. Those are the only proper milieu for maple syrup.
Fair enough. Shall we stop off at a Waffle House for a breakfast special?
If you find one that's open, I'll pay.
Ha! Deal!
Will you two please shut up? I'm trying to friggin' sleep.
Of course, John. Sorry.
Waffles.
Pancakes.
Phew. Gumbo.
In the cab, Christy sharply jerked her head to the right as something flashed by in the distance.
Pass me your long eyes, will you, lover?
Studying the woody hill on the right side of the highway, Ryan could only see the misty forest.
Something wrong?
There's a vill up there. I wonder if...
Fire blast.
Christy saw too late the thick tree trunk lying across the highway.
Shit!
A half a dozen grinning people poured out of the forest and quickly headed for the busted vehicle. They were dressed in forest camo, with leafy branches lashed to their squirrel fur jackets. Their boots were merely thick layers of cloth held in place with strips of green rawhide. The garments were crude, the hide badly cured. But bare steel knives were thrust into knotted rope belts, and everybody sported a club and a homemade gun. The primitive weapon was composed of only a thin tube attached with strong twine to a block of wood. A precious .22 caliber round was stuffed into the tube, and nailed to the back was a spring-driven mousetrap with a nail attached to the killing bar as a firing pin. The weapons looked haphazard, almost comical, as if they were about to come apart at any second, but each deadly weapon was adorned with a neat row of notches, indicating the owner's number of successful kills.
Shit fire! We got a big one this time! biggest I ever seen!
The leader of the Cold Hearts waved his homemade weapon and checked for any movement from the passengers or driver.
Delay! Inga! Watch for any sign of Levine and his tech men! Martin, Betty, Spencer, check the cab!
As the others spread out, Martin went to the passenger door.
Looks like we got a chill driver! And, hey, we got us a slut!
Yanking back the wooden stock of the Kalashnikov, Christie suddenly flipped it over and pulled the trigger. But the rapid fire did nothing. The slam it got against the dashboard must have broken something inside. Casting it aside, she pulled her SMW-38. The round made a small hole in Martin's squirrel skin jacket, but came out his back the size of a fist.
What the? Holy no, she ain't smart! Kill the slut!
Taking aim, the Cold Heart thumbed the pressure plate of the mousetrap, the killing bar snapped forward, and the nail struck the Predark 22 caliber brass. A soft lead slug smacked into Christie's wheel gun, sending it spinning away. Flexing her stinging fingers, she turned to race after her wheel gun. She could see it plainly lying on a patch of asphalt, the burnished steel reflecting the dappled sunlight. Before she could reach it, the woman called Betty threw her club in a sideways motion.
No need to chill the slut. Alive, these thieves can ride her for weeks before we sell her to the slavers for muskets and flints.
The stocky blonde grabbed Christie by the collar and hauled her up. Suddenly, the redhead buried her hidden knife into the belt of the Cold Heart. Christie dived for the wheel gun, coming up with it held in a two-handed grip. But the Cold Hearts had already taken refuge behind the fallen trees spanning the highway. She knew a round into the tree would force the rest of them into sight, but there were four shots left in the gun and four Cold Hearts. She had several speed loaders on her, but positioned out in the open, those might as well be empty for all the good they do her right here and now. Just then, the cracked windshield of the Mac was blown into pieces as Ryan, recovered from his impact with the steering wheel, fired his Kalashnikov on full auto. The 7.62mm rounds hammered along the top of the fallen tree, throwing up bark and splinters. Clutching his bleeding face, the man called Delay stood and turned to run, but Christie had him in her sights. The Cold Heart flopped down out of sight. Instantly, Christie broke for the flatbed. Then, something launched into the air from inside the fortified flatbed. The glass bottle arced across the highway. A Cold Heart stood, beating at the fire with her hands and gun. The weapon was triggered, and a gout of red blood blew out of her thigh. But the burning woman never seemed to notice, as her long hair ignited to completely engulf her face. At the apparent signal from the woods, the remaining Cold Hearts broke from cover to race down the slope toward the pine trees. Taking careful aim, Ryan waited until they were all in plain sight. Incredibly, the leader of the Cold Hearts still kept moving, although no longer for the tree line. Weaving drunkenly, he turned, his face slack, and his mouth drooling slightly. Getting a bead on the Cold Heart, Ryan could see that while the body was still breathing, there was nobody inside the riddled head anymore.
Everybody okay out there?
Ryan rubbed his aching stomach. When the Mac hit the tree, he had slammed into the steering wheel, completely knocking the air out of his lungs.
Then better.
Better than them, anyway.
Suddenly, a group of armed men and women charged out of the pine trees from the other side of the highway. Running in formation, every person was carrying a long rifle of some kind. Everything from a BAR to a flintlock. The only identical feature of their mixed clothing being a rawhide fringe hanging from their gun belts. Stopping near the splintery end of the tree, the armed newcomers glanced at the dead bodies on the asphalt.
Nuke and hell! The Outlanders Ace Dexter's gang! Hip hip hooray! Hip hip hooray! Hip hip hooray!
A big man on a horse galloped out of the woods. The rider was broad and tall, with black hair and a full beard with sideburns hanging down in oily ringlets. The man wore a uniform of some kind, with the insignia removed, and there was a gun on each hip. His dark clothing was clean, and his leather boots shone with polish. Nobody had to tell the companions that this was the local baron.
So what the hell happened here? Looks like Dexter and his mutie-loving Phoebes tried another jacking, and this time got jacked themselves.
Christie walked over to stand by her lover.
That's about right. You the baron here?
Mind your tongue, Outlander! He's the Lord Baron to the likes of you.
At ease, Sergeant Bernstein. Yeah, I'm in charge of Pineville. The name is Levine, Avram Levine.
Ryan Carter.
And I'm guessing you're the leader of this group?
Close enough. This is Christie. Back there is J.B., Mildred, Doc, and Jack.
J.B. was resting an arm along the top plank of the wall, his Uzi held in a casual grip. Just because folks smiled nicely didn't mean shit to him.
So, Lord Baron, I gather that we did you folks a favor by taking out these bastards?
Did us a favor? Hellfire, we're gonna throw a party tonight over this chilling. These mountain men have been jacking most of the wags that come this way for years. Not everyone, but enough. Raping, taking slaves, stealing everything they could. We've been hunting them for a dozen winters, and this is the closest we've ever got. Only one that ever chased them away for a while was John Rogan.
The sec man nodded in agreement at that, but the companions went stiff.
Come again? What was that name?
Trader Rogan. John Rogan. He runs a convoy through the Great Salt and around Badwater Lake. Sells blasters, ammo, panes of glass, crop seeds, some tools. Just about anything useful. Even books, sometimes.
Does he indeed, sir?
Some time ago, Delphi had hired a group of four brothers to try to track down the companions to murder Ryan and capture Doc. The cyborg had equipped them with electric motorcycles, working radios, M16 assault rifles, Grens, and a host of military gear. Their names had been John, Edward, Alan, and Robert, the Rogan brothers. The companions had killed the Coldhearts, so Doc surmised that now Delphi was using one of their names, probably in an attempt to disguise his real identity. Doc wondered who the cyborg was hiding from.
Sure. We've heard of the guy. Dresses all in white?
Yeah, that's him. Hell of a traitor. His convoys helped keep this ville alive. Sold us meds once that stopped a dose of black cough that nearly wiped us out.
Did he?
Bet your ass. Saved my wife and babe and never asked for Jack. Some folks say he's the traitor. You know, the one that fought in the Muti Wars. But Rogan says that was somebody else.
Be a great honor to meet him. When is he due here again?
Couple of weeks.
Ryan tried not to grimace. They had to be at the end of his route, which logically meant if they hurried, the companions could hit him from the rear. A good idea, but with one big flaw. Annoyed, he glanced at the battered war wag. It had stopped dripping fluids from underneath, but looked as if a hard fart would make it fall apart. Ryan slung the Kalashnikov across his back. That was an old trick of Trader, the real one. Holster your weapon in the middle of cutting a deal, and the other fellow would be more interested in doing business.
Any chance you got a mechanic or a blacksmith in your ville?
Got both. Be glad to have you stay here for a while. Till first snowfall, if you like. I offered a month of food and shine for anybody who got one of the cold hearts, so I owe you that much at least. Besides, everyone's gonna want to meet the people who sent Dexter on the last train west. Now, do you think we need to drag it uphill with some horses, or will it roll? I'd say no, but I've been wrong before.
I'll let you know in a minute.
Getting into the cab, Ryan tried the ignition switch. Quickly, Christie got back into the passenger seat. She held the door closed by draping an arm outside the window.
Lead the way.
Sergeant Bernstein, stay here with two others to clear the highway. Everybody else with me. Double time, boys, unless you want to drag it home.
Walking sullenly, the sergeant stepped out of the group with two other sec men, and the rest of the armed norms broke into a fast trot, heading back toward the dense woods. Ryan followed close behind. Once off the highway, Ryan saw a crude dirt road snaking through the sloping pine trees, going to a large ville standing prominently on the crest. Not surprisingly, the outer wall appeared to be made entirely of logs, although there was something odd about them that he couldn't quite see from this distance.
What do you think, lover? Obviously, Delphi's impersonating John Rogan. Should we wait here for Delphi or go after him once we're back on the road? That is, if we can fix this rolling pile of shit.
First, I want to know more about why Delphi is treating these folks like they were blood kin. Then we'll decide on where and how we chill his ass.
Fair enough. You think they might actually be kin?
There's no way to tell for sure. I guess it could be. But more important, we need to know how many sec men he has, what kind of blasters, how many wags and such. I prefer a stand-up chilling, but I'll settle for drilling the bastard the way I did Silas, if that's what it takes.
That was a hell of a shot.
The wind was with me.
I just hope the bastard cyborg hasn't made any more smart stickies.
I hear you.
Edgar Franklin's proximity sensor activated, detecting a bloodthirsty screamwing nearby. He drew his needler and looked up, his eyes filtering out the background light, until he spotted the deadly little mutie coming at him at over 100 miles per hour. Stepping over the smoking corpse, Franklin took out his canteen. He continued his journey through the pre-dark ruins. He was dressed in loose rags and mismatched boots, his backpack made of more patches than original material. A long, jagged scar had been carefully pasted on his face, calluses on his hands, and his teeth stained a mottled brown to simulate rampant decay. The man could barely recognize himself, which was good. That might buy him a few seconds of indecision before Delphi attacked. And in a contest between cyborgs, a split second could make the difference between life and death. The old corroded Colt 45 revolver at his hip was fully functional, but it was purely window dressing, to make him appear the part of an itinerant wanderer. His backpack held only a few meager possessions, plus the mandatory trade items, a glassine envelope containing a single Aquapure tab, spent brass suitable for reloading, and a carefully ripped and then taped wall poster of a naked pre-dark woman. She was most pleasing to view, and would buy him out of a lot of trouble in most vills. Under his dirty clothing, Franklin carried a small arsenal of weaponry, several of which were surgically embedded into his body, including a self-destruct charge. If Franklin should die, anything near him, especially Delphi, was going to be obliterated by an HE charge of staggering power. Shuffling along the barren streets, Franklin marveled at the excellent condition of the buildings. Post office, bookstore, hair salon. A lot of them had intact roofs. Many of the signs were still legible, and there was even glass in some of the windows. Although every pane had been sandblasted to a milky white by the never-ending desert breeze, the same with the cars. Every inch of paint had been removed from the chassis. Only the models made of fiberglass retained their original colors, the touches of metallic green and iridescent blue strangely incongruous amid the rest of the beige and gray landscape. It was plain that World War III had been very kind to the city of Tucson, not a single nuclear bomb detonating anywhere near the sprawling metropolis. All of this damage was clearly man-made, probably from the rioting mobs searching for food and killing scientists. Turning a corner, Franklin saw a gap in the row of buildings. Cracked bricks and broken masonry strewn across the street, the foundation reduced to merely a blackened crater. The cyborg raised his hand to check the map on his PDA. This was the place where the local baron and his sekmen had destroyed a nest of the modified stickies created by Delphi. What a gargantuan waste of time and effort that had been. Intelligent muties. The phrase was an oxymoron. The things were incapable of advanced learning. Franklin saw the dying light of the sunset glint off something shiny in the distance and stopped in his tracks. There it was at last. Tucsonville had to be very close for him to see a reflection from the greenhouses surrounding the citadel. Easing closer, he paused at the side of a vast field of broken foundations and cracked asphalt. A dozen buildings had to have been brought down in the middle of the city to create this large empty field. But the pieces of the structures had not been wasted. In the middle of the clear zone was a walled city, a city within a city, the outer wall rising 10 yards high, the top sparkling with broken glass and barbed wire. In these dark days, it was a most formidable barrier. The front gate was colossal, composed of overlapping pieces of metal and wood, railroad ties, car doors, sheet iron, everything and anything the locals could find. A ring of concrete K-rails formed an irregular pattern in the ragged field. Franklin knew those were positioned to break the rush of the muties or any human invaders in war wags. There was a term for it. A shatter zone, he dimly recalled. Obviously, these humans had not fallen quite so far as those in Florida or Oregon. Rising high behind the massive wall was a truncated skyscraper, the roof cut at a sharp angle, clearly damage done from the nuclear wind of Skydark. That was the so-called Citadel, home of the Baron and his family. Backing away slowly so he wouldn't attract attention in case there was anybody watching the ruins, Franklin eased around the corner once more until the ville was out of sight. Looking around, he spotted an empty hardware store and went inside. The shelves were vacant, of course, but more important, there were the remains of an old campfire. That would lend a lot of credence to his story. Sliding off his backpack, the agent of Titan started making camp. When night fell, the light of his campfire would attract any stickies in the crumbling city. One would do in a pinch, but 20 would be much better. A nice hooting mob of muties charging through the ruins, and intent upon his bloody murder. Pulling out the Colt, the cyborg cracked open the cylinder to check the position of the 4 dead rounds. A dozen or so stickies would be perfect. Then he could start his real work. The long trek up the hill had been arduous, the diesel constantly stalling and flooding. But eventually, Ryan got the shuddering machine onto level ground, and the struggling engine smoothed out a little. Not much, but enough so that the temperature gauge lowered a hair. The thick forest ended 100 feet away from the ville, the rocky ground dotted with low tree stumps, the air redolent in the thick smell of pine. Anybody or thing trying to reach the ville would cross that open ground and be an easy target for the ville defenders. This close, Ryan could now see what had caught his attention at the bottom of the hill. The log wall of the ville rose about 20 feet and was completely covered with intricate carvings of grizzly bears, bull moose, mountain lions, soaring eagles, and fiery mushroom clouds. Naked Sek women beheaded stickies with swords, volcanoes spewed lava, and giant worms battled pre-dark army tanks. Some of the designs seemed new, while others were darkly weathered. Only the front gate was different, the smooth surface covered with sharp sticks draped with concertina wire. Sek men walked along the top of the decorated wall, and guard towers rose from behind, along with numerous thick plumes of smoke. This was obviously a heavily populated ville. A gallows hung over the wall at one point, a rotting corpse dangling from the noose. The arms ended at the wrist, the hands missing, indicating that the crime of the deceased had been theft.
Gaia, I've never seen anything like these carvings before.
Must be a bitch doing fresh ones every time the wall gets damaged from a fight.
Ryan guessed there was really nothing wrong with making a ville wall pretty. He'd just never seen it done before. Those elaborate carvings told him much about the locals. Unless they had a lot of highly skilled slaves, which was unlikely, the people in the ville didn't mind hard work, and that meant that they were good fighters. Not because of physical strength, although that always helped, but because of the discipline involved. Willing workers made good fighters. One just seemed to go naturally with the other. Ryan frowned at the thought.
Hope this isn't the source of Delphi's convoy hands.
Ryan watched as the Baron galloped toward the ville. The front gate swung open, exposing an inner bulwark of crushed rock topped with a muzzle-loading cannon. The Sek men and women behind the cannon crisply saluted the Baron as he rode by with the running Sek men close behind. Ryan directed the warwag through the gate and angled around the bulwark to enter the ville. The amassed Sek men behind the bulwark didn't salute this time and watched the wag in close scrutiny, scarred hands resting on the holstered weapons by their sides. As the Cyclops rolled past the formidable gate, Mildred could only stare at something nailed to the wooden jamb. A small roll of paper, or maybe parchment, tilted slightly off-center.
Madam, am I mistaken, or was that a Jewish prayer scroll on the gate?
Sure looked like a mezuzah to me. Maybe this mountaintop ville was a winter ski resort before the war, or at least a winter retreat. Perhaps a lot of Jewish people left the big cities around Christmas to get a break from the non-stop barrage of carols for a holiday they don't celebrate. Possible.
Then Skydark hit in January, trapping them here. So they turned the ski resort into a fort to survive.
The companions had encountered villes ruled by Aztec priests, the Amish, Russian czars. A religious group such as the Jews would make sense. After civilization crashed, the world had been up for grabs, and a lot of folks reached out to seize a handful for themselves. It was nice to know that a couple of bills were being run by thinkers and scholars, instead of the usual amoral sociopaths. As the war wag started down a wide street, packed with bricks and loose gravel, every civilian in sight stopped whatever they were doing to gape at the machine with ill-disguised contempt. Who could blame them? The Mac was literally held together by duct tape now. It could come apart at the seams at any moment. But it had made it this far without bursting into flames. Whatever else was true about the desert cannies, they were definitely good mechanics.
Where'd you get all of those fancy rapid fires? You got any more brass for them? What would you take in trade?
JB noted a shallow gutter running down the middle of the street. That could be for gathering drinking water, or to cool the rain to extract the sulfur to make black powder. Possibly both. Not surprisingly, wood seemed to be the primary construction material in the Forestville. Nearly every building was made of hand-hewn beams, the lintels adorned with intricate carvings, ranging from obscene to comical. Only the roofs were different, a wild conglomeration of plastic sheeting, sheet metal, and crude clay tiles, anything capable of withstanding the deadly acid rain. Closely watching the passing crowds, JB saw that there were a lot of people carrying crossbows, but only the Sec Force had guns. If the companions had to leave in a hurry, that would aid their departure a lot. The air smelled of boiling soup, freshly sawed wood, spent black powder, curing leather hides, fresh bread, horse dung, and of course, the all-pervasive aroma of pine.
Look over there!
In the alleyway between two stores were a lot of junk cars and trucks, piled three, sometimes four layers deep. Among them were a couple of large vans, a tractor, a snowplow, and a Mack truck cab. The tyrant rims were gone, the gas tanks rusted through and full of buzzing bees, but the wreck was exactly what they needed. That was, if any of the hoses were in good condition. There was even a windshield that was only mildly scratched.
Bingo! Is glass hard to install?
Nah, easy. Just have to make damn sure it doesn't drop. Hopefully our flintlocks and black powder will fetch a good price from the Baron. We're best sure not trading any of our modern pieces.
The Baron rode around a corner. As the war wag followed, Ryan saw a large corral full of horses and a couple of large barns. One of them had the outline of a horse painted above the doors, while the other had a castellated gear. Nobody needed to know how to read to figure out which was for horses and which was for wags. Coming to a halt, Baron Levine slid to the ground and pointed at the barn doors. A couple of the Secmen rushed forward to throw them open wide, showing a large interior covered with sawdust, the walls lined with neat rows of parked vehicles, brown delivery vans, beamers, a police car, and a lot of snowmobiles.
Park it in the back, near the grease pit!
Ryan got the huge vehicle through the doors without hitting the jam. Jack stayed in the rear to guard the supplies and spare weapons.
You know, Outlander, I had a dog make similar noises to your wag. I shot the poor thing out of sheer kindness.
Then boiled it for soup, I suppose?
Of course. Why waste a perfectly good dog?
Sounds like a mitzvah of mercy.
Every Sec man in the barn turned their attention to the physician, and the Baron slowly raised an eyebrow.
And how do you know that holy word?
An old friend used it a lot. Said it meant a good deed or an act of kindness.
It does. And I'm pleased to know there are others of our faith still alive in the world. I assumed we were the last of the Israelites.
No, there are others. Not a lot, but some.
Are there? Good news indeed.
By now, a crowd of villagers had gathered outside the barn, most of them with small children. They all craned their necks for a better view of the war wag and the Outlanders, but nobody dared walk into the barn. Wags and guns were only for the Sec Force, even if they didn't work. That was the law. Villagers were not allowed to even touch such things.
Lord Baron, there are some wrecked wags back in the ville. Do we talk to you about doing a scav for spare parts or somebody else?
Unfortunately for you, those belong to Sergeant Bernstein. But I'll see that he accepts any fair offer you make.
What about the homemade blasters of those cold hearts? Those should come to us for doing the chilling. Is that enough?
Yes, those blasters would be enough for anything you want. That is, if he can also have their clothing, boots, and knives. Do we have an accord?
We have an accord.
Done and done. Let's go to my home so that you can wash and meet my wives. I'm sure they'll be eager to meet the people who have removed the thorn of Dexter from the side of our ville.
We'll be happy to come for dinner, but we're sleeping here with a wag.
Fair enough, I suppose. I could offer to put guards on the barn to protect your belongings, but they would be my guards, so what's the point? You've earned our trust, not the other way around. Sergeant Cuthbert!
Yes, my lord.
Send in some braziers and charcoal to keep our guests warm through the night. I'll see the banquet tonight.
At once, sir.
At the doors, the crowd parted to allow a hunchbacked woman to shuffle into the barn. Her long hair was the deepest black, nearly ebony, with only faint wings of silver at her temples. Her dress was worn but clean, her moccasins layered with different colored patches. The hump on her back was pronounced, nearly bending her double, and she walked stiffly with obvious difficulty. Stepping a few yards away from the companions, the wrinkly raised her head to show that her eyes were pure white.
What is it, Haviva?
I have a message for the newcomers. Those who walk
The invisible road that spans the world below the ground.
The companions became tensely alert. They didn't know who this woman was, but that had sounded like a pretty good description of the gateways hidden in the subterranean redoubts.
All right.
Everybody out! The Doomy needs to speak privately with the Outlanders.
All of the others quickly left the barn. Only the Baron remained. Nothing happened in the Ville without his knowledge and consent, and that included future events. The companions stayed in place, closely watching the wizened hunchback. They had encountered muties before with the gift of seeing into the future. Doomies were usually sickly, as if their frail bodies could not support the terrible weight of the knowledge in their minds. Doc brought over a burlap sack of sawdust and placed it behind the hunchback. Fumbling with a clawed hand, Haviva found the lumpy bag and sat.
Which one of you is the leader?
That's me. What do you want to tell us, old one?
Raising her head, Haviva directly faced Ryan.
In the sand, there is a key hidden in the sand that opens the door that cannot be approached. You must find that key in order to slay the ancient giants. The giants want only good, to help all of humankind. Their hearts are pure, but their plans will fail, and we shall pay a terrible price in new fire.
Where are the giants?
Ryan glanced sideways at the Baron. Levine was listening to the conversation in total confusion. The less the man knew, the better.
But you know where they are. You have seen their home. That is the door.
The door that can't be approached, huh?
No. I speak the truth. The giants have sent a holy warrior to find the machine that walks like a man. But they must not succeed, or else that death will forge a chain that ends us all.
How do we find the holy warrior? Is he also part machine?
He does not matter. Only his servants. Friends will kill you by trying to save you. Enemies will save you by trying to kill you.
She grabbed Ryan's arm, her fingers digging in hard.
Find the key. Open the door and kill the ancient giants. Stop the new fire.
Do the giants have a name?
Nodding, the Doomy reached out a hand to move a bony finger through the dirty sawdust on the floor, making a small circle, then a large oval that cut through the middle, and on the left side she made a crude star. Astonished, Mildred scowled at the pattern. It looked like the astronomy symbol for the planet Saturn.
Titan. That is the symbol of Titan.
Moving fast, JB used his boot to wipe the symbol from the floor. Doc continued to stare at the floor, then slowly turned to walk away, pursing his lips. A large grin appeared on his face. Christy was speechless. The man couldn't even look at the symbol.
Tell me, Haviva, do these ancient giants, are they, do they speak softly?
Yes, you understand. The giants whisper.
Jerking back, Mildred recoiled from the words as if physically struck. Doc had told them that the time-trawling project had been a division of Over Project Whisper.
Enough of this shit. Where's the bastard door? Where's the key?
But you have seen them both. You see them all the time.
Where? When have I seen them?
In your dreams.
The woman slumped strangely, then eased to the floor and went still.
What? She fell asleep? I'll wake her.
Jack reached out to shake her.
Don't bother, Jack. When she stops, that's all you'll ever hear on the subject again. The strain of seeing the future is becoming too much for her. Every year, our Dumi says less and sleeps more. Soon...
The Baron shrugged. All things died. Not even a Baron could do anything about that. Kneeling, Mildred suspiciously placed two fingers on the carotid artery in the throat of the woman, checking for a pulse.
Haviva's not asleep. She's gone.
What? Impossible.
The Baron shook the woman hard.
Haviva! Haviva!
I'm truly sorry. I wish there was something I could do.
She died giving you this warning. It's like Haviva was waiting for you to arrive before she could allow herself to finally let go.
Pity it didn't make any sense.
Ryan instantly regretted the lie. From the dour expression of the Baron's face, he was deeply insulted by it. Scowling darkly, the Baron pulled a knife and put a small cut into his left sleeve. Then sheathed the blade.
Goodbye, little one.
He gave the material a tug. Recognizing the gesture for what it was, JB respectfully removed his hat. The others bowed their heads. Then, going to the wag, Mildred retrieved a blanket and draped it over the dead woman. Haviva hadn't been under her care, yet the physician still felt as though she had lost a patient.
Enough! Life goes on. I'll send in some sec men to remove the body.
The Baron turned to the door.
As for you folks, get to work on your damn wag. I gave you a month, and my word is stone, but after that, you're no longer welcome in my ville.
But Baron...
Levine turned to look at the covered form on the floor.
30 days!
Taking it hard. Think they can?
Doesn't matter. We were planning to leave long before a month passed, so this hasn't really changed anything. Wreck the ville, fix the wag, and then go after Delphi.
But if chilling the cyborg will start another Skydark...
The Dumi said the person sent by Wet Doc called Titan couldn't chill Delphi. She didn't mention us at all.
True.
The predictions of a Dumi did not always come true. Time flowed like a river, not a concrete road. It was forever changing, flowing, taking on new patterns. The mere fact that they had gotten a hint about what was to come might change the outcome all by itself.
Swell. Now it's a race to see who aces a cyborg first, us or these assholes from Titan.
If the Dumi was telling the truth.
Yeah, big if.
True.
Pulling out a scrap of paper and a pencil, Mildred made a copy of the design. For some reason, the design seemed familiar.
So what is this town you've been dreaming about, Ryan? I don't think you've ever mentioned it before.
It was during the Muti Wars with Traitor. I fell into a lake and ended up in some fake Adobeville. One building really stood out. It had that symbol the Dumi drew on it. But when I got too close, something jumped me back to Traitor and the other wags.
Dark night. I always did wonder what happened when you fell off that hill. Hell of a tale. Sounds like you saw something that you shouldn't have and got chased away, like a dog pissing on a vill wall. Whoever these folks are, they could have aced you easily enough.
Just dropping me back in the lake would have done it.
But the only thing you ever saw was the vill, which logically means it must be someplace special. Perhaps a pre-dark fortress, or even the Master Redoubt.
Where'd the soldiers go?
Maybe.
Taking a seat, Ryan frowned at the unsettling possibility. Tangling with the cyborg was going to be a tough enough fight, but if this was another anthill, or even a redoubt full of pre-dark soldiers, they'd be walking into a rad pit of trouble. Uneasily, he looked at what remained of the design in the dirt. Just for a second, there was a flicker of memory about the white building in his dream. Then it was gone.
It might even be the laboratory that Doc escaped from.
The words hung thick between the companions, filling the air like invisible chains to focus their attention upon the tall, elderly-looking man standing alongside the war wag, his head bowed in somber contemplation.
Well, that would explain a lot of things. Well, the little Dumi hung on just long enough to pass us this morning. Sounds like we'd be triple-stoop fools to ignore it. Doesn't matter if it's the home base for this Titan person or just a hard site for Delphi. We have to do a wreck.
Fair enough. If it'd help Doc, I'd kick a nuke in the ass. You know where it is?
Not really. That whole damn journey is blurred in my head. But you were there, JB. Any chance you recall me falling off a cliff during the Muti Wars?
Yeah, I do. Happened just that one time, about 100 miles from here, at a place called Lake Powell.
Tensely alert, Ryan waited for some internal reaction to the name, but nothing happened. Maybe the warning from Haviva had somehow freed him from the mind block he seemed to have about the damn place. He had no idea why people from this Titan group were after Delphi, but he felt certain that the mystery would be answered once they got inside that white adobe building with the symbol for Titan above the door. The crackling firelight cast dancing shadows across the sandy street, the reddish glow inside the pre-dark store making it resemble the bloody mouth of some hungry beast. Sitting near the campfire, Edgar Franklin tossed another piece of wooden door onto the flames. Hot embers swirled and danced upward to the smoke-stained ceiling. Twilight had come and gone. Now black night ruled the pre-dark ruins, softening the angular contours until it seemed like a vast stone canyon full of arroyos, buttes, and rills. A tumbleweed rolled along the boulevard, moving past the gaping storefront as if it were late for an appointment. Franklin added another piece of wood to the fire. Even in death, the great city maintained the precious illusion of life. Picking up a galvanized aluminum pot, the cyborg poured some coffee into a cracked ceramic mug. The pungent black brew was strong and bitter. There was a packet of powdered hot chocolate secreted inside the folds of his clothing, but that was being saved for a trade item. In somber retrospect, it seemed to him that the entire world had become one huge prison, where the strong preyed on the weak, and food was the only real currency. Besides weapons, of course. It was nearly midnight, and he was becoming quite impatient. The ruins were supposed to be filled with stickies, but he had heard rumors of something called the Metro being used to eradicate most of the muties. Perhaps it was true, but if nothing of sufficient size arrived soon, he would have to take matters into his own hands, wounding himself with a knife and staggering to the ville claiming he was attacked by cold hearts. It would be much more believable if he was seen being chased by some stickies. Just then, something large stirred in the darkness outside the store. A shambling mockery of life lurched from the darkness and into the red firelight. A dozen ropey tentacles thrashing around, a billowing white mist obscuring the body of the oncoming creature. For only a brief moment, Franklin vaguely saw the face of the thing, the skull obscenely split in two, as if two or more heads had merged together, or perhaps were in the process of separating. Franklin stood and quickly backed away. It was a howler. The bedamned monstrosities were one of the horrors of the Deathlands, and nobody knew what they were, aside from death incarnate. The whitish mist surrounding them was a powerful neurotoxin. Even a drop on bare skin paralyzed a person. True omnivores, howlers ate anything they could reach, and only a single one of them had ever been successfully killed without resorting to a nuclear device. As the howler moved through the empty doorway, Franklin threw his needle. The discharged pins hit the howler in the chest, if it had a chest, and punched clean through, doing no visible damage.
Shit!
In unbridled fury, the howler charged, its deadly tentacles lashing out in every direction. Again, the flechettes passed through the mist-shrouded body as if it were a hologram. Keeping to the middle of the store, its tentacles spreading wide to prevent any possibility of the prey slipping past, the howler moved directly into the campfire, seemingly unaffected by the flames. That broke his resolve, and Franklin turned to pelt toward the rear of the store. He had to get outside. He needed room to maneuver. The cyborg found the metal fire door wouldn't open, no matter how hard he tried. Then he saw the jam was bent, warped from the collapse of the upper stories. Franklin turned the beam on his weapon to the door to start cutting out a crude circle. As it worked, the needler in his grip became uncomfortably hot, a weapon designed for single shots, not continuous operation. He felt a painful stinging start on the back of his neck. Curse Coldfire for never sharing the secret of their force fields. Glancing nervously over his shoulder, Franklin saw the thing was dangerously close, the white mist billowing outward, discoloring the rubber floor tiles. In desperation, he pulled his Colt. The muzzle flash temporarily parted the swirling mist, giving him a glimpse of the creature underneath.
No! Impossible!
Franklin threw himself at the portal with all of his strength. The door cracked and tore open, and Franklin fell to the ground. Scrambling to his feet, the Titan agent sprinted into the cold darkness toward the Ville. All considerations of trying to trick his way inside were gone, replaced by the heartfelt desire to get his ass safely behind that big wall. Dodging past the concrete K-rails, the cyborg tucked away the needler and fumbled to empty the dummy shells from the Colt. Taking refuge behind a 3-foot-high K-rail, the cyborg rested the Colt on top of the concrete divider. The howler responded by heading toward him faster.
Help! Help me! Open the fragging gate! Open it!
Franklin turned and ran. Straight ahead, he could see dim shapes moving along the top of the wall. The segment on the wall disappeared, and Franklin felt a wave of dismay. Then there was a sudden flurry of movement in the dark sky above. He watched 3 Molotov cocktails plummet from above.
Idiots! Fire has no effect on howlers!
Then more objects came pelting down to land in a rough circle around the shambling creature. Each metallic tube tipped with a short fuse.
Pipe bombs!
The Molotov cocktails had been thrown, only to highlight the target. More pipe bombs dropped around the howler in a precise pattern. The cyborg was impressed. The blasts had been way too powerful for black powder, gunpowder, or even pre-dark dynamite. They had to be gun cotton. It seemed that some unsung genius in the Ville had rediscovered the ancient Civil War explosive. Once again, his estimation of the Ville went up. Perhaps this Ville could be used for some of his own plans. Lashing insanely, the howler seemed to be trying to attack the explosive charges. As the gate opened slightly, the night was slashed apart by a sliver of light that slowly expanded. Franklin dived through the narrow crack. Scuttling away from the ever-narrowing crack, Franklin saw the howler reach the opening and thrust out a tentacle as the gate closed. The tip nipped off. A piece of ropey length fell to the ground and wiggled around mindlessly until a Sekhman skewered it with an arrow from a crossbow. Lifting it warily, he swiftly climbed a broad flight of wooden stairs to the top of the wall and tossed it back into the night. The titanic portal shuddered as the creature rammed it from the outside.
Still here? Try this, fucker!
From the top of the wall, a Sekh woman lit a fuse, then threw down a pipe bomb and stepped back. The Sekh woman looked down and grinned.
He got the message, Chief. The howler is moving back to the ruins.
Ceasefire!
The Sekh chief holstered his gun. There was also a BAR strapped across his back and a large knife tucked into his left boot. His face was heavily scarred, the overlapping patterns almost obscuring some sort of a blue tattoo on his throat. Only a few yards away from the gate, Franklin saw a sandbag nest filled with Sekh men holding guns and Molotov cocktails. Aiming at the gate was a large muzzle-loading cannon, a stiff fuse jutting from the end like questing antennae.
You heard the chief! At ease, you bastards!
The armed guards slung the BARs over their shoulders. Barely visible behind the sandbags was a pyramid of wrought iron cannonballs, along with several lumpy cloth bags. Franklin identified canister rounds. During the Civil War, such items were made of thin sheets of tin and filled with hundreds of musket balls. But these homemade versions probably contained only small bits of junk, broken glass, bent nails, busted pieces of pottery, anything the Ville couldn't readily use. But fired from the maw of a black powder cannon, and the barrage of debris became a shotgun blast of devastating potential over a short distance. Franklin didn't know if the hammering could have slain a howler, but it would have shredded anything else. And at the very least, the sheer force of the multiple impacts would have thrown the mutie back outside again, so the gate could be closed. Then the cyborg did a double take at the sight of 2 of the men carrying canvas bags slung over their shoulders, the sides decorated with a large red cross.
Now, as for you...
The chief Sekh man crossed his arms.
Can't say you've earned a lot of friends here, Wrist, bringing a fragging howler down our throats.
The term the man had used, Wrist, was short for tourist. Tucson had once been a vacation city, but after Skydark, outsiders were extremely unwelcome, and the word became slang for a non-resident. The cyborg noticed just how many Sekhmen were standing near the gate, their hands full of weapons, Molotov cocktails, pipe bombs, and torches. That was disturbing. Titan did not have the secret of force fields like Coldfire, and there was enough weaponry here to dispatch him without much effort on their part.
I had no choice. I was... My dreams forced me here.
Your dreams?
I'm here to find a man called Silver. In the dream, a friend of his was in terrible danger and needed help.
Yeah? Well, I'm Chief Sterling. Steve Sterling. Been told that's a kind of silver. What's the name of this friend of mine?
Dusting off his clothing, Franklin shook his head.
I don't know his name for sure, but it's got something to do with the rain.
Rain?
Yes. He is tall, very tall, with black hair and only one eye. Carries a curved knife like nothing I've ever seen before.
Suddenly, not one of the weapons was pointed at Franklin anymore.
Nuking hell, that sounds like Ryan. Not Rain, you Phoebe, Ryan. And you say he's in trouble? Where is he?
I do not know where. When I sleep, there are dreams and I see distant faces, events, wars, births. They mostly come true.
So you're a Doomie?
No, I'm no Mutie. I'm a Norm. I am nothing like that thing outside.
Blind Norad, there ain't nothing like a Howler this side of hell. And we get lots of folks in here with a little Mutie blood in them. So don't worry about that. The Baron has never hung a wrist for being different. What's your handle?
Adams. Eric Adams. And I am not a Doomie.
Sure, sure. You just have dreams sometimes and they come true. Hey, no biggie, right? Everybody dreams.
The Chief Sekhmen had an idea what was going on here, but if this Adams really was a Doomie, then he needed to be handled as gently as a newborn colt. Doomies were incredibly rare, and even more valuable. Advance warning of a drought, or acid rain, or Mutie attack could save the whole vill. Of course, there were folks who sometimes only pretended to be Doomies to try to get food and shine from the Baron. But the cure for that was easy. Slit the tendons so the liar couldn't run, then toss him naked to the next sticky that happened by the vill.
Sounds like nuke shit to me, sir.
Lieutenant Edward Rogan held a shiny blue Webley .44 caliber revolver. A machete hung under his left arm in a leather shoulder holster. The brass was loaded with black powder now, but worked as good as ever. Advancing a step, the colossal lieutenant nearly made Sterling look small. The barrel-chested giant had countless small scars on his face, until it seemed barely human. A gold ring dangled from his left ear, and he walked with a pronounced limp. Turning, Franklin looked directly at the much larger man.
The river was deep enough to spare your life, but not your leg. And you lay unconscious for a night and a day before your chief came along to drag you out of the mud and build a fire.
Ah, everybody knows that story. We tell it over Shine at the Gaudy House. Now, a real fraggin' Doomie.
You worked for the machine that walked like a man. He gave you and three others pre-dark things. Machines with wheels and rapid fires. He stood behind glass that could not be broken and called himself Delphi.
Ugh, Delphi.
There was no way anybody else could know those things, especially about the invisible wall that protected Delphi from guns and knives. Rogan had never even told Chief Sterling that detail, and he owed the Sec boss his life.
Guess you really are a Doomie. So, what's this about Ryan being in trouble?
Frag that shit. You know anything about Delphi?
The giant man couldn't care less about Ryan and the others. They had tried to kill him, and he'd survived only because of that nameless river and Chief Sterling. But it had been a fair fight, and he held the Outlanders no grudge. But Delphi was different. That was a personal matter. And the last Rogan brother had sworn a blood oath to find and kill Delphi no matter what the cost. Sterling stepped between the two and grabbed Franklin by the arm.
Tell me about Ryan first. Where is he? What's the trouble? Talk fast, and I'll fill your pockets with live brass. Dozens of rounds. Tell me.
To
Dozens?
Guaranteed. Now talk.
My dream was about both. To the far north, past the Great Salt, is a ville by a lake. The rocks are blood red, the water dark green, and there they shall meet. Rain and Delphi. But only one will walk out of the pre-dark ruins alive. Sometimes it is the one-eyed giant, and sometimes the man dressed all in white.
Sounds like it ain't been decided yet. And I can make the difference?
Yes, but only if you hurry. And it may already be too late, unless you get there before...
Before what? Talk, wrist!
Making a vague gesture with his hands, Franklin shrugged and reeled a little bit, stumbling to stay on his feet. All Doomies were weaker than breadcrumb coffee. At a motion from Sterling, a couple of Sekhmen rushed over to take hold of Franklin and help him to the sandbag nest. A plump, blonde Sek woman kept a close watch on him, while the others moved away to hold a conference.
Shitfire, Chief! We owe Ryan and his people a triple lot for their help with those muties. If they're in for a shitstorm, then count me in to help.
And me!
Cut the chat. The Doomy said the dream was only for the Chief and me.
Besides, the rains will be coming soon, which means we'll be hit by cold hearts seeking shelter, new muties, cannies looking to get fresh supplies of meat. The rest of you have got to stay here to guard the ville.
Maybe we should check with the Baron. He owes Ryan a blood debt for saving Daniel and his brother.
Tell him in the morning. I'm leaving right now.
Sir?
You heard me.
Hey, Hannigan!
Masked by shadows, the door to a pre-dark auditorium swung open, exposing a fat man holding a lantern. Behind him were wooden stalls holding the ville horses and mounds of green hay.
Yes, sir!
Get my horse saddled and pack a week's worth of food, plus a dozen pipe bombs!
No! Get a couple of horses ready, along with one of the new med kits, plenty of water, and fill the fragging saddlebags with every pipe bomb they can hold!
Chief!
Sterling and Rogan looked hard and long at each other. Then the chief nodded grimly.
You heard the lieutenant! Move your ass!
Yes, sir!
A few minutes later, the stable hand returned with the mounts. Sterling and Rogan climbed into the saddles.
Okay, Sergeant Hassan, you're in charge until we get back. Give us a move. After that, consider us chill. But don't send any rescue parties. This is a private matter and not Bill Biz.
I'm sure Baron O'Connor would say different, but since I can't talk to him till morning, that's just too nuke and bad for me, I guess.
Yeah, you'll be a grunt by dawn.
Yeah, I've been there before and I still made Sergeant faster than you.
Fair enough. Protect the Baron and watch your back, old friend.
You too, sir.
Walking his dark stallion toward the gate, Lieutenant Rogan paused near the sandbag nest.
You better be right about this, Adams, because getting chilled by a howler ain't nothing compared to what I will do to you if this is some sort of trick.
Avoid the Hollowlands and watch for a painting of a winged horse.
A what?
A red horse with wings. You shall find what is needed there.
Rogan shot the man a suspicious look, as if questioning his sanity, then faced the gate.
Open her up!
You sure about this, Chief?
Checking the load in his sawed-off scattergun, Sterling said nothing. Delphi had walked right up to the man as he lay bleeding in the grass, then walked away, chuckling. The memory burned in his mind.
Any sign of the howler?
Clear as shine, but there's something moving in the ruins to the west.
Stickies?
Can't tell.
Punching the reins in one hand, Rogan drew the Webley. He wasn't afraid of dying, only failing. Delphi had gotten his entire family killed, and now was his chance for payback.